Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. The Jewish strategy of dominance and power is seldom one of open conquest by force of arms. Instead, it is the strategy of biological parasites, which make their way into a society built by another people, often in disguise. Once ensconced inside the gates, they begin to secretly and then openly work in concert against the host society. They undermine its solidarity, corrupt its institutions, and spread memes of anarchy, chaos, and a concocted morality, the central tenets of which are the evil of protecting or preserving the host population and the moral imperative to protect the parasites, which are newly and increasingly defined as possessing a kind of divinity. It is most instructive to study the Jewish strategy at work in the ancient world. No man is better qualified to increase our understanding of this subject than the late great Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver. Classicist, linguist, scholar, and one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. This week, we continue our excerpts from his insightful work on the subject under the title, The Jewish Plague, Part 4. I give you the words of Revelo P. Oliver. The Jews have always been physically, that is, numerically, a weaker people. Wherever they have lodged themselves, they have been a small minority among the Goyim. A large part of the Jewish force in every country consists of Morenos, Jews who, using the chameleon-like ability of their species, effectively disguise themselves. I have often glanced through the lists of births reported by the Jews in their own Detroit Jewish news, and I could not but notice that on many days there was no name that betrayed the race of the child. The personal names of the parents and children were all Christian names, with some preference for names that are traditionally Scottish, and the family names all suggested British, French, or sometimes Slavic ancestry. Those instances of the Jews masquerading under assumed names, it should be remembered, are all of Jews who, by inserting such announcements in their own newspapers, confess their race. Many Morenos eschew such indiscretion, and some are so adept at disguise that their acquaintances and associates are astonished when some accident or indiscretion discloses the race of a person who seemed to be an American, Englishman, South African, German, Frenchman, or other member of our own race. But even when we make every allowance for the Jews' mastery of disguise, we must admit that they are still a minority in the United States, where they are surely outnumbered by the Aryans, who are probably still an absolute majority in their own country, and outnumber the total of all the aliens in their midst, Jews, Congoids, mulattoes, mestizos, Mongolians, and the like. If the feeble-minded Aryans, instead of subsidizing the prodigious breeding and proliferation of their domestic enemies, and even importing hordes of others from Vietnam, Haiti, and elsewhere as refugees for the eventual extermination of the Aryans' own children, were sufficiently intelligent and resolute, they would still have the power to expel or otherwise eliminate all of their alien parasites, among which the Jews are a small, though prepollent, minority. Throughout history, the Jews have everywhere been a minority in the countries into which they have intruded themselves, and they have necessarily employed the weapons of the physically weak against the physically strong. Before the foundation of the highly militarized State of Israel, which depends on American money and technology, the Jews have never captured a territory by open warfare and invasion. They have never been sufficiently numerous and strong to attempt an open conquest, even if they had been so temerarious as to waste their own lives to attain what they could more easily and safely attain by deceit. It is true that the Jews' myths include two claims of open conquest, but both of these are indubitably fictitious. One of those stories is well known, since it is found in the collection of Jewish tales, commonly called the Old Testament, by our people. According to that myth, the Jews, with the help of their tribal deity, openly invaded the land of Canaan, ruthlessly butchered all the inhabitants, and even the inhabitants' domestic animals, and then appropriated the country they had made a bloody desert. The tale, even when divested of such nonsense as a claim that the Jews' God stopped the sun and moon, luminous disks that were floating in the atmosphere at an altitude of about 50,000 feet, and held them stationary for a time to facilitate the rapine, is utterly incredible, and no reputable historian, not even among those who profess to be Christians, pretends to believe it. The tale of armed conquest is intrinsically so incredible that Philo Judaeus, one of the ablest of the Jews' apologists and propagandists, who in the early years of the first century tried to convince intelligent Greeks and Romans that the Jews were not a menace to civilization, had to admit that the story was preposterous, and that what must have happened was that the Canaanites voluntarily permitted the Jews to penetrate their country peacefully and set up synagogues and the rest of the Jewish racial organization, after which the Jews, of course, took over. Philo candidly admits that when the Jews peacefully penetrate a country to despoil it, they, in their own minds, naturally regard the inhabitants as enemies. But he seems to hesitate between alternative explanations of the Canaanites' suicidal folly in permitting the Jewish immigration. The stupid Canaanites were either impressed by the holiness and superiority of their covert invaders, or had their minds befuddled by the Jews' God. It is possible, of course, that some nucleus of truth may underlie the Jews' story that they captured city after city of the Canaanites, butchered all the men, butchered all the women, butchered all the children, butchered all the oxen, butchered all the sheep, butchered all the donkeys, and then relaxed in blissful contemplation of their own holiness. There is archaeological evidence of the destruction of cities by war, as well as by earthquakes in or near the time of the supposed conquest. But from what we know of the Jews' racial habits, we may guess that after their peaceful immigration, they promptly started subversion and civil wars, and were soon able to use one army of stupid Goyim against another army of stupid Goyim, so that the natives slew one another and destroyed themselves, while the Jews egged on the contestants and rubbed their hands gleefully together, much as recently they stampeded their British and American cattle into Germany to facilitate their pious appropriation of the earth that their tribal god contracted to give them. The second story of armed conquest comes from another Jewish propagandist, Josephus, who was a little younger than Philo, and whose story of a conquest of Egypt by the Hyksos long imposed on historians who did not take into account the Jews' racial genius for forgery and deception, which is now so vividly illustrated by such hoaxes as Anne Frank's diary and the nonsense about the 6 millions of God's race that the Germans supposedly killed before the 6 million crawled into the United States and other Western nations. Whether Josephus forged the passage that he claims to quote from Manetho or utilized the work of some earlier Jew is uncertain. He relies heavily on the Jewish forgers of earlier centuries, especially the ones who assumed Greek names, much as Jews now masquerade under such names as Ashley Montague, Lyle Stewart, and Craig Schiller, so that Josephus can pretend that they were Aryans who testified to the vast superiority of God's race. What is certain is that there was no conquest of Egypt by the Hyksos. It is now known, see the Cambridge Ancient History, and especially the definitive work on the subject, The Hyksos by John Van Cedars, that the Hyksos were peoples, probably of several different tribes, that spoke Semitic languages, whom the Egyptians indiscriminately described as Asiatics, and who infiltrated Egypt by gradual immigration across the Sinai Peninsula, and probably never were numerous enough to form a very large fraction of the population. They were clever enough, however, to spread sedition and incite civil wars until they attained a rule over the entire nation, placing as governors in each district tributaries and stooges, many of whom were certainly or probably native Egyptian traitors, and using an uncertain proportion of Egyptians in the troops by which they maintained their dominion for almost 2 centuries. An Egyptian revolt finally succeeded in overthrowing the alien rulers and expelling many of them, for we may be sure that some of the aliens managed to blend themselves into the native population and escape notice. But during their control of Egypt, the immigrants incited massacres of the upper classes and promoted the mongrelization that the stupid Egyptians had themselves begun by importing black slaves from the south. And they left the nation genetically impoverished by a great infusion of both black and Semitic blood, from which Egypt never recovered. There are some indications that the quote-unquote Asiatic immigrants came from the regions that are now Syria and Palestine, and the methods they employed to ruin Egypt makes us consider seriously Josephus's claim that they were Jews, and that when they condescended to leave Egypt, they built Jerusalem as the capital of the region they then occupied. Unfortunately, there is no evidence, other than the remarkable similarity of methods, to confirm or refute a conjecture that the Hyksos were organized and directed by Jews. In the past century, before the Jews' habitual duplicity and mendacity were generally recognized by historians, Josephus's story was rejected because the enemy aliens brought with them into Egypt a god named Set or Seth, whom they regarded as the enemy of the Egyptian gods, although they also talked about religious toleration when it suited their purposes, in keeping their stupid subjects bemused. They evidently proselytized for their patron deity so effectively that he remained in the huge crowd of Egyptian gods after the end of their rule, although he was then most commonly represented as the diabolic assassin of Osiris and other native deities. So long as it was supposed that the Jews were uniquely devoted to a tribal god whom they called Yahweh, or Yahoh, who is designated in the Old Testament by a wide variety of names that have been concealed by the translators, who, beginning with the Septuagint, use a word meaning Lord to translate a number of different names. It was then thought axiomatic that the worshippers of Set could not be the holy Jews. But it is now known that the Jewish colony at Elephantine, which was regarded as perfectly orthodox in Jerusalem, had five gods in a pantheon, of which Yahoh was merely the chief, and that the Jews worked any convenient religious racket. For example, claiming in Egypt that the Egyptian god Osiris, the greatest of all gods, had inspired Moses and the prophets of Israel and had chosen the Jews as his special pets. So, in the present state of knowledge, we must leave it an open question whether or not the enemy immigrants into Egypt were led by Jews. If they were, the Jews were at work as early as circa 1760 BC. If not, we have no certain historical trace of the race before more than 1,000 years later. You've been listening to The Jewish Plague, Part 4, written by Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver and presented by your host, Kevin Alfred Strom. To read more of Dr. Oliver's works, visit nationalvanguard.org/Oliver. That's nationalvanguard, all one word, .org/Oliver. We'll continue this important discussion of the Jewish question by classicist, scholar, and teacher Dr. Revelo P. Oliver next week on American Dissident Voices.